the question is, what's the Department of Homeland Security going to do now? Are they just going to slap their wrist?
The Escopeta drill rig arrives in Kachemak Bay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 9th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a pesky moth could spell the end for some Alaska berry patches.
As soon as people go to their favorite blueberry spot to look for the blueberries, they're probably going to be a little surprised that they're not going to be there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com. ConocoPhillips has extended operations at its Kenai liquefied natural gas plant until October to fill an additional order. The plant was to have been closed earlier this year, but the company was able to fulfill four orders, three to Japan and one to China. The plant was to have been mothballed after the last shipment, which went out last week, but ConocoPhillips spokeswoman Natalie Lohman says that the plant will be open an additional 2 months because of this latest order. Details of that order were not immediately released. Lohman says the plant is still scheduled to be mothballed after this order is shipped. Kachemak Bay sees all manner of strange vessels, large and small, but the appearance this week of an enormous jack-up drilling rig caught many local residents by surprise. Some folks are wondering if the rig's owner, Escopeta Oil and Gas, is violating federal and state law by moving it into the bay. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
Homer City manager Walt Reedy was among those surprised to wake up Monday morning to the sight of a massive drilling rig in Kachemak Bay.
We were a little surprised to see it show up in the bay yesterday because the information we had was that it was going to go, when it got to Cook Inlet, it would go right to the work site.
And that was the original plan, says Steve Sutherland, strategic officer for Houston, Texas-based Escopeta Oil and Gas.
General plan was to head into Cook Inlet and go to our drilling location, which is north of Nikiski. When they contacted customs and let them know that they would come into Kachemak, then customs requested them to bring it to Homer so that they could board it and have a look around.
That process was completed Monday afternoon, says Sutherland, and now the rig is waiting on some paperwork to clear before it can be authorized to move to the kitchen lights unit, a drilling area southeast of Tyonek that Escopeta plans to explore. Even before its arrival in Alaska, the Escopeta rig had been the subject of some controversy. Bob Shavelson, the executive director of local environmental watchdog group Cook Inlet Keeper, says Escopeta is blatantly violating the federal Jones Act by using a foreign flag vessel to transport the rig between U.S. ports.
The question is, what's the Department of Homeland Security going to do now? Are they just going to slap their wrist? Or is there going to be some more serious penalty? Because the Jones Act is treated very seriously. You know, they can confiscate that entire rig.
Escopeta's position, says Sutherland, is that a 2006 waiver to the Jones Act should be enough.
You know, I don't really know how it's going to work out in the end. But, you know, we're just doing our best to find energy for the nation and the people of Alaska and doing the right thing, and hopefully the feds will do the right thing.
Shavelson also wonders whether the rig should even be in Kachemak Bay in the first place, pointing to the designation of the bay as a critical habitat area. That law, passed by the state legislature in 1993, says, quote, to avoid damage to fish and wildlife habitats, drilling rig storage will not be allowed in the Kachemak Bay critical habitat area.
From that perspective, it is surprising to see the rig in Kachemak Bay because state law forbids it.
Sutherland counters that when the rig is in its present state, with its 400-foot-long legs folded up and out of the water, it's basically just a big barge.
It happens to have a derrick on top of it, but it's, you know, just another vessel sitting out in Kachemak Bay.
The Escopeta jack-up rig, known as a Spartan 151 rig, will be working at its drilling site in North Cook Inlet in a week or two, hopes Sutherland. The exploratory project is slated for 8 drilling seasons, including this one, and Sutherland says it could provide up to 400 local jobs in Nikiski and Kenai. During the winter, Sutherland says the company's preference would be to tie the rig up at Nikiski. They are presently working with the Coast Guard about that possibility. If tying up at Nikiski is not possible, the rig will have to tie up at another ice-free port. Sutherland says that port will definitely not be Homer.
No, we don't have any plans to bring it to Homer again. Probably be the last time they see it at Homer, be my guess.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Among the issues legislators anticipate dealing with during next year's session is a revived effort by the Parnell administration to lower the state's taxes on oil production. The House passed the bill that lowered taxes last year, but the Senate refused to advance it until the administration and the oil industry provided more information on the tax's effect on production and employment. The Senate this week contracted for a study to get some of that information, particularly to determine who is working in the industry, what they are doing, and if they are Alaskans. Jim Calvin is president of the McDowell Group Consultants, the company that will do the study. He says the job is to assemble a look at all the information available on the labor force for the state's oil industry.
The heart of the research is to really understand what has been happening in the industry over the last, in terms of employment, over the last few years, is employment trending up? Is it trending down? And what specific components of the industry is employment trending up or down? You know, we do know that much of the published data only presents part of the picture. So what we've promised to do is drill a little bit deeper and make sure that we understand who all the players are in the industry.
Much of the data the study will need is confidential, and some will have to come from private companies and will require voluntary cooperation. Calvin says a complete labor picture for the industry includes such support activities as camp services, transportation, and security. He says the workforce also includes professional services that take part in North Slope oil fields.
We want to make sure that those jobs are factored into the analysis as well, and really understand what the resident non-resident situation is, and if it's changing much over time. We have data that suggests that it moves from time to time depending on if there's growth or decline in the industry. But we want to look at that a little in some more detail and make sure we understand what's happening today.
The McDowell Group has extensive experience in oil industry research in the past, a fact recognized by Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker. Hawker was skeptical of the study when it was first proposed, but says he now anticipates a valuable return from McDowell. However, Hawker cautions, the employment study will not address the issue of oil production, and that is the heart of the tax reduction case.
We've got to appropriately compartmentalize this work and keep it in the context of what purpose it really serves, and not let us use this study as an excuse to not move forward, not consider the importance of Alaska's competitiveness in the world market for oil and gas investment dollars that actually increase production.
The final report is due to the Senate Finance Committee on December 1st for use during next year's session. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an intrepid group of Russians kayaks the Cusco.
We go to an old site district looking for remains of the old buildings, so forth, and ask a lot of questions.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Berry crops in South Central Alaska, along with many shrubs and trees, have suffered this year from a widespread geometrid moth outbreak, causing defoliation in many plant species. According to Michael Racy, an integrated pest management technician for UAF Cooperative Extension Service, this type of moth is native to Alaska, but this particular behavior hasn't been documented in the state before. Though many plant species are currently struggling, Racy says that many should survive.
Since it is a lot of our native plant material, the stuff is very sturdy, very hardy, has, you know, they all have very pretty extensive root systems that they can actually survive some of these defoliation events. But like I said, that has a lot to do with how the plants were doing to begin with. Some stuff, there's no doubt that it may struggle to survive after 2 years of consecutive defoliation.
Racy says this outbreak began in 2009 on the southern Kenai Peninsula, and this year it has spread up as far as Hatcher Pass in the Matsu Valley, and residents can expect it to affect berry crops in many areas along the way.
Here in South Central, you know, right now, yeah, I think, you know, as soon as people go to their favorite blueberry spot to look for the blueberries, they're probably going to be a little surprised that they're not going to be there, or not in the same amount that they were in the past.
Racy says that areas on the southern Kenai Peninsula should see a significant decrease in moth activity within the next year, but the northern Kenai Peninsula will likely have another year or so of heavy defoliation. According to Racy, the best way for people to help their plants survive is to keep them watered and growing as healthy as possible. Obesity is a national problem. Diane Peck is a public health specialist with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services Obesity Prevention and Control Program. She's working with a panel called the Alaska Food Policy Council, which is putting together a program aimed at both reducing the number of overweight Alaskans and in pointing them toward eating healthy local foods.
What we are doing is taking a look at policies that can impact our food system, and that can impact our economy and our health.
So is this Food Policy Council something recent?
We received some funding through my office to take a look at establishing a Food Policy Council in Alaska about a year ago. And over last summer, we had different groups looking at what are some of the issues in production. What are some of the issues in our supply chain? What are some of the issues with health and hunger and justice? And now we've been able to get a facilitator to help us really do some strategic planning. And that's what we've been doing over the past 2 days, look at what our vision and mission and goals and objectives will be for the coming 3 years.
So we could say that the council actually covers a sort of wide scope of issues. Your specialty, so to speak, is obesity. How does obesity fit into the big picture?
Well, one of the things that food policy councils can do is to help increase the access that people have to healthier foods, particularly local foods. The thing that we're particularly interested in is increasing the access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So we're really looking at things that increase farmers' markets and CSAs and increase production of fruits and vegetables here in Alaska.
You know, Alaskans are the picture outside of the state is these sort of rugged individuals, outdoorsy people. But in reality, are we sort of more and more dependent on the supermarket?
I think when it comes to most Alaskans, we are very dependent on outside food sources. You know, we're not sure the exact statistics, but there's an estimate that about $2.5 billion that Alaskans spend on food actually gets shipped down to the lower 48 because we're so dependent on the stores now and the food that they bring up from the lower 48.
That dependency on the outside has a couple of aspects. One, you brought up the economy. Are there any goals which the policy council is trying to reach to encourage people to shop locally, so to speak?
Definitely. You know, we have a goal to encourage consumers to buy more local, but also looking at providing more local, too, because right now we don't have as much as we need to support the state. And so looking at things that we need to help to support producers, particularly processing, you know, we don't have a lot of processing facilities. We don't have a lot of storage.
Public health specialist Diane Peck. A federal judge has dismissed a suit filed against the local hotel employees union. Judge H. Russell Holland threw out the Sheraton Hotel's claim that Unite Here Local 878 actions had cost the hotel thousands in business losses, while upholding the union's First Amendment right. The dispute started almost a year ago when Sheraton Anchorage Hotel filed suit in federal court in Anchorage, charging that Unite Here, the union that represents many of the hotel's hourly wage employees, had defamed the hotel and cost it more than $638,000 in lost revenues. Unite Here conducted a boycott of the hotel, picketing and urging hotel guests to join the boycott. Earlier this month, Judge Holland ruled that the union's actions were protected by the United States Constitution and the National Labor Relations Act. Matt Fennell is a staff worker for Unite Here.
Workers at the hotel are fighting for a fair contract that guarantees them safe workloads, job security protections, and affordable family medical insurance.
A similar suit filed by the Sheraton against the National Labor Relations Board last year was also dismissed by a federal district court judge. The union's unfair labor practice charges against the hotel include the firing of four union leaders, according to Fennell. Unite Here is still awaiting an administrative law judge's decision on those charges. Local Sheraton Anchorage Hotel management had no comment on the issue. Texas-based Ashford TRS Nickel LLC owns and operates the Anchorage Hotel. The company's attorney, Carl Cherrell, said in an email that the court committed an error in dismissing its lawsuit against the union.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by North Rim Bank, taking your business to the next level. With help from North Rim Bank, spot the turns and opportunities that lie ahead for Alaska. More at northrim.com. Member FDIC. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Apple says it's opening its first retail store in Alaska. The Apple store will open on Saturday at the Fifth Avenue Mall in Anchorage. There were months of speculation on company-related blogs fueled by a covered storefront under construction at the mall that the Cupertino, California-based company was coming to Alaska. Today's announcement came the same day as the iPod, iPad, and iPhone maker surpassed ExxonMobil Corporation as the most valuable company in the United States. Oregon-based rock band Portugal the Man has lost all of its equipment after its touring van and trailer were stolen from a Chicago parking lot. Reports are that the band lost dozens of items, including vintage guitars and amps, keyboards, effect pedals, drums, and microphones. The band's Ford van and trailer were taken from an attended parking lot on Monday. The band was in Chicago to perform at the city's Lollapalooza Music Festival. Lead singer John Gourley says the band had only recently acquired all the equipment they needed to make the music they want and put on the live show their fans have come to expect. The band, and Gourley, hails from Wasilla. The Alaska Department of Education and Early Childhood Development won't release this year's statewide adequate yearly progress report until Friday, but Anchorage released its results yesterday. Anchorage graduation rates are up, but fewer schools are meeting the new adequate yearly progress standards. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Although the federal No Child Left Behind Act is now officially the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the demanded 31 categories remain. That includes a key one for the Anchorage School District and its superintendent, Carol Como.
The four-year graduation rate is roughly 71.8%.
That compares to 2009-2010's approximate 68% graduation rate.
And the five-year graduation rate, which we've also been calculating for the first time, is about 75%. So these are preliminary, but it's good news.
Beginning this year, the state changed how it calculates the high school graduation rate to match other states. That makes exact comparisons uncertain. Still, Como's convinced the rate has risen. Just how much?
I don't know for sure. That's what we're going to have to do in an analysis once the data gets firmed up by October. In the profile of performance, I think we'll be able to answer that with certainty.
5 years ago, the graduation rate was 62%. In contrast, the number of schools meeting AYP academic goals dropped.
The language arts and math scores did go down. Average scores went down because the proficiency bar went up this year, another sizable amount.
As of this year, for a school to meet the academic categories, nearly 83% of its students must pass the language arts and nearly 75% must pass the mathematics portion. That level applies to the school as a whole and 9 student groups. There are racial and ethnic categories, but also economically disadvantaged, students with disabilities, and limited English proficiency. However, a failure to meet adequate progress does not mean the school's academics did not improve.
We know a number of schools didn't make adequate yearly progress, but they're still showing growth. They just didn't meet that bar, and I don't have the statistics there.
Last year, 47 Anchorage schools made AYP. This year, 37. This year, 17 schools missed by 1 or 2 targets. Last year, 16 missed by only 1. Como pointed to some noteworthy improvements.
For the first time ever, the Alaska State School for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing has made adequate yearly progress. The Whaley Center also made AYP in language arts for the first time. Those young people who struggle with many behavior issues on top of the academics. And so for them to make AYP at this higher bar in language arts is a real significant growth for them.
Other points of pride?
2 of our Title I schools, North Star Elementary School, for the first time ever, made adequate yearly progress, and Lake Otis Elementary School also made adequate yearly progress.
The other 2 Title I schools which achieved AYP were Avail and the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School, the latter for the 2nd year in a row. The district's 25 Title I schools have a large percentage of economically disadvantaged students and qualify for extra federal aid. But there are also federal sanctions if they continue to not meet AYP. One is parents can choose to send their children to other schools, but Como says only about 1% decide to do so. She says each school will now begin an in-depth examination of its results.
When the teachers come to work this week, one of the first things they're going to be doing with their in-service is taking all their data and looking at where they made proficiency and where they didn't, which groups of kids didn't.
The Federal Education Act calls for every public school to reach 100% in all categories by 2014. Como said some research estimates that this year up to 85% of the nation's schools did not meet AYP. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A unique set of visitors showed up recently in Dillingham. The group of Russians are retracing the roots of the late 19th century Russian explorers. KDLG's Melody Kay stopped in on their pre-trip blessing ceremony at the local Russian Orthodox Church in Dillingham to find out more.
O Holy Father, Seraphim, pray unto God for us.
Dillingham Russian Orthodox Church parish priest Father Nicholas Vick was joined by Father Makrayi in delivering prayer service in Yupik, Russian, and English. The mixed language prayer service is common for this part of Alaska, but Father Makrayi's presence was unusual. Though dressed in a traditional Russian Orthodox Church cassock and a monk by profession, he was actually part of a Russian expedition team looking for the legacy of Russian America in Alaska. According to the expedition sponsor, the Russian Geographical Society's website, the goal of the trip is to explore and document the portion of North America known as Russian America, which includes the Alaska Peninsula, the Aleut, Commander and Kuril Islands, as well as parts of California and Hawaii. These areas were explored by navigators from the Russian Empire between 1799 and 1867. And if you ask Father Nick's son, Timothy, it seems the eight explorers were avid documentarians in search of Russian connections to today's Alaska. The team, which includes a historian, a geologist, a naturalist, a medical doctor, and a journalist, even recorded Timothy in the Makai, or steam, as he explained what Yupik words might have Russian origins.
I was telling them what the different Yupik words that we got, that we adopted from their language. And before I started, they stopped me, they put a wire on my collar, and then they put the camera in my face, and my mind just kind of went blank. And then it was kind of hard to recover from that, but I told them what I could do. I remember.
Not that their local host didn't learn anything either. Father Nick said he was surprised at how many cultural similarities there were. For one, the Russian team was familiar and appreciative of steams, but they also had tundra or Labrador tea from their experiences with Russian Siberians.
They're busy whenever they get to a particular, like the beach, they start looking, or when they go to an old site, they start looking for remains of the old buildings, so forth, and they ask a lot of questions.
The explorers are now partially retracing one 19th century naval officer's 900 kilometer route to the Yukon River community of Russian Mission. The expedition team plans to first visit the upper Woodtickchick Lake from the Niyokok tributary of the Nooshigak River just north of Kalignik. Then they plan to track west, starting with a portage over a mountain west of the Nooshigak River to Shotgun Creek, where the team will paddle down the creek to the Halitna River and eventually spill into the Kuskokwim River. At the community of Kalskag, they will then portage again 70 miles west to the Yukon River community of Russian Mission, where they hope to have arrived and flown out of by September 2nd. The explorers are currently headed to the Nooshigak River community of Ekwok.
Holy Father Herman of Alaska, pray unto
God. Reporting in Dillingham, this is Miladi Kay.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Miladi Kay in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.